This week on the BOAG World Show, we talk growth, scope creep, co-creation, and performance. This week's show is sponsored by Videoblocks and Currency Fair. BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show, are you ready for this? Lee Howes, Drew McKellen, Dan Edwards and Tara Simon. Hello all.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, everybody's there and everybody's audio's working and all is good with the world. Let's just hope that it keeps up through the entire show. Just to remind you that if you haven't listened to any of this season yet, we are doing a round table discussion, as you might have gathered by the number of people here. And each person is going to bring a kind of different thing to the table each week that we're going to talk about and discuss. And different people have different areas of expertise. So we have Dan Edwards, who is kind of covering designy related stuff. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Paul.
How's it going this week? What have you been up to?
I've been doing a bit of all sorts, really. But I mentioned in the last episode, I had my first client workshop.
How did that go?
Yeah, it went really well. Yeah, it was really interesting. And I think, well, they definitely found it valuable. I found it really valuable. And it's been really interesting. So yet to see kind of how it's going to impact the rest of the project, purely because we were doing this kind of pre-project, you know, sort of like a discovery phase. So, so that'll be interesting. Other than that, I'm moving house soon. So I've just been prepping and getting stuff ready for that.
Oh, lucky you. I just despise that with a passion.
Me too.
I vowed that I'm never moving again now. We're done. Talking to moving, Drew, you moving to Ireland yet?
Not yet, no.
You're only talking about moving the business, mine, aren't you?
We're only talking about moving the business just so that we're based in the EU.
Yes.
After Brexit.
Yes.
Because we already we sell in euros and dollars and pounds. So we're already in multiple currencies. So we figured that there are so many advantages of being in the EU, we might as well move the business and take advantage of them. It's only a short flight from here. We're in Bristol.
I know, it's not far, is it? Because you're Bristol-based, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's so right. What you've been working on this week, Drew? Anything interesting? Any new features that you want to leak to the wider audience?
I've been working, amongst other things. One of the things I've been focusing on this week is just to fill anyone in if they're not familiar, we build a content management system. And one of the things I've been looking at is our process for uploading images, which sounds like a really, really simple thing. You know, you upload images, you find that in every single web application. But I've just been paying an extra little bit of attention to, you know, making that a really nice process, making sure you can just grab a image file and drop it in a logical place and it just sort of work and you get good feedback if things fail. And, you know, just that sort of thing.
That's the thing I envy you, right? One of the nice things about working on either as part of an in-house team where you're working on the same site all the time or building the same product all the time is you get to spend attention on that kind of detail. When you work for an agency, you're always moving forward. You're always kind of pushing on to the next thing and you're always kind of building foundations, but you never get to go back you do sometimes, but generally you don't get to go back and kind of obsess over those little things. And I miss that.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I could obsess over 1,000 different things. So I have to really be careful not to spend too long obsessing over any one particular thing because there's just so much to be done all the time.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But yeah, we can get that shot to go back and revisit things, which is good.
Which is very good. And Lee, what about you? What have you been up to? It's been a while since we've had you on the show, isn't it, mate?
Yeah, well, I usually fill in, don't I? So everyone's been available, I guess. What have I been up to? Done a couple of workshops this week. Busy doing stuff. Loads of projects on. loads to do.
What were the workshops? What kind of workshops were you doing?
We did a customer journey mapping workshop.
Okay.
and then some a wireframing workshop, basically, sort of sorting out information architecture.
I'm doing some customer journey mapping next week, so with Headscape, actually. So, yeah, me and Chris are going up to London to do some, which would be very nice.
Will you have jumbo posters, though? You need jumbo post-it notes.
Yeah, you've
these
got...
These are the new thing.
This is the new thing, isn't it? I've seen these. They're, like, enormous.
Yeah, it's really good because if you're in a big room, nobody can read tiny little post-it notes, which, of course, are the mainstay of doing all kind of workshops. But if you're putting them on a wall... Especially with your handwriting, Paul. I'm not sure anybody will ever be able to read them. So
handwriting is fine, thank you very much.
Jumbo post-its, about four times the size, like 4K post-its, that's what they are.
That sounds good. So there you go, Dan. There's the tip for you next time you do a workshop. Make sure you've got jumbo
post-its. I've never heard of this. This is a new thing. I did look for like big post-it notes because, as soon as you write on them, everybody just has to kind of go right up to the wall and squint to be, especially with my handwriting. I'll admit my handwriting is terrible. So,
put an Amazon link on the show notes.
Yeah, yes. Getting those affiliate pennies in there.
All those, yeah.
Oh, that could be my affiliate idea. Yeah. Podcast. Now, it's good to have you back on the show, Lee, even though you were very rude about it. You said, didn't you say that last week was boring? Did you say that? Or episode one?
I think I said it sounded very sensible and grown up, and I'm just not used to it, Paul.
That is what you said. It was sensible and grown up. You didn't say it was boring. I just interpreted that. It means the same thing to me. And we've got someone completely new on the show this week, which is Tara Simon. Nice to meet you, Tara. Apparently, we've met many times before, and I've just forgotten. But tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and where you're from and that kind of thing.
Sure. I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the lovely U.S. I work for a technology consulting firm called Atlantic BT. Been doing project management now for probably the last 15 plus years. Recently moved over to being our director of client engagement. So putting a lot of focus in on how to make sure we're managing client expectations, satisfaction, while at the same time still delivering projects the way that you should.
See, look, that was so slick. I'm so impressed. The rest of us have been going, I've been doing some stuff this week and faffing around. And then you're in there, I lay it out exactly what you've been doing and who you are. And so slick. It's Americans. You're just slicker. That's all I can say.
Well, it's also earlier for me right now, so I'm still drinking coffee and trying to wake up.
Well, we're on the downward spiral to the end of the day in misery. Well, the end of the day isn't misery, actually. That's the wrong way around, isn't it? Yeah, I know what I meant. All right, so that's the group that we've got here today. We're going to dive into some content in a minute, but before we do that, we're just going to do a quick thing for our sponsors. Videoblocks have been supporting the show this season and will continue to do so most of the season, actually. They're really supportive, in fact, the entire season, should I say. They're an affordable subscription-based stock media site that gives you unlimited access to premium video stock footage, which these days is so important as we introduce more and more video onto our sites. And I'm certainly doing loads of video work, and I know other people are as well. What I like about it is it's just so simple and straightforward with its licensing. So it's got like a members library and a marketplace as well. So there's some content if you're subscribed and you're a member that you get access to for free as part of the subscription. That's a huge library of content. And then there's other marketplace content which you can buy as you require. So everything's 100% royalty free. So even if you're a subscriber and your subscription ends, you still have that video that you've downloaded and you're using, you've still got the rights to use that. It's not kind of limited to just when you're subscribed. It's royalty free for personal and commercial use. There's no hidden fees or anything like that involved. So it really is a great way. If you're looking for stock footage to add in, they've got a great service. And I think it's really good value for money. And they're offering listeners to this show a really good deal as well. You can get a year's subscription for only $99, which if you think about it, the amount of footage that you could download in a year, that is really extremely good, and it's a $50 discount on its usual price tag, just for people on this podcast. So it's less than $10 a month for really unlimited stock footage. You can get the year subscription today for $99 by going to videoblocks.com/BOAG World, B-O-A-G World. All right, so let's jump right in and kick off straight away. I promised you, Dan, as you got bumped from last week's show, we ran out of time, that we would start with you this week. Now, Lee said, and I quote, "That's a really boring subject I don't care about."
Thanks. Yeah, just no, ignore it. Sorry.
So now I've set it up so well, Dan. What do you want to talk about this week? You've lost the desire to now, haven't you? You've been crushed by Lee.
I'm going to talk about chewable coffee. No, I'm not. that is a thing, by the way. I've just had a chewable coffee thing.
Well, isn't that how coffee started, people chewing it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but this is like little cubes. They look like OXO cubes, covered in sugar and then made out of coffee.
It sounds disgusting.
They're not great.
So how much caffeine has it got in it then?
You know what? Oh, it does say somewhere. Caffeine, 100 milligrams per serving. That's 2 pieces, but I've only had 1 piece. So
I don't know how much that is. That's about the same as a normal cup of coffee.
A cup of coffee has 200 milligrams in it. So.
Oh, well, there you go. Oh.
But coffee. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about growth and firing. So I read this interesting article. It's not a new article. It was written earlier in this year by Jason Fried. I think that's how you pronounce his name, founder of Basecamp. And it's called Gut Checking Growth. And essentially it hit a few... well, it made me think, really, because we kind of grew from 2 people to 6 people fairly quickly. And since then, we've gone back down to 4. And when we had to let the first person go, it was kind of, well, it was a horrible, horrible experience anyway. And something that I, you know, never wish upon anybody that runs a business. Basically, we kind of thought, well, what next? And, you know, we didn't hire for a little while, and then we did hire, and the person we then hired was a project manager, so not a developer or a designer or anything like that. And that was great, and that was good, and everything was fine with that. And since then, we've also had one of our PMs leave. So a few things have changed. But anyway, what got me thinking was, or what kind of made me rethink what we do after that, you know, going back down to 4, is what do we do next? And in this article, basically what Jason does is kind of asks those questions. So, you know, he says, for example, just to quote him, "Whatever the reason, when somebody leaves, it's a great moment to break out of the replacement mindset and ask yourself what would happen if you didn't replace that person." Mm. Because, you know, it's very easy to get into the pattern of, right, we've got work, we've got a certain amount of people, they're busy, and therefore we always need that amount of people. But if somebody leaves, you then basically have an opportunity, as he says, to kind of break that pattern and think about, you know, what if you gave yourselves a few months without the role? For example, you know, there's always more work to do. So, for example, it feels very natural to just put more people on it. But, you know, could, for example, you just stay at, say, 5 people and do what, you know, 6 people were doing, but without kind of overloading those 5 people? And what if actually use it as an opportunity to think, well, maybe that means we don't need to just be grabbing every piece of work that we could get, because we suddenly don't have the pressure of having those people. And it just is, all it really is kind of just putting the question there. You know, it's a rare opportunity to question growth. And obviously there's so many hidden costs as well with growing, you know, organizational complexity and communication breakdowns and people to kind of move around and manage. There's not, you know, not just the simple things like the overhead of actually hiring somebody. So it sparked the question to me, you know, what do you do and when is the right time to hire? You know, do you work at 120%? I've heard somebody mention this, I can't remember who. Do you work at 120% for, you know, 3 months just to see if you can manage with those people before you hire? Or is it best just to, you know, kind of stay small, stay lean, and then grow organically, you know. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of put the question out there myself to you guys and see maybe what your experiences were with that.
This is something that has always been a pet subject of mine, or pet peeve of mine, is this, especially with agencies, this assumption that you bigger is better the whole time. And that you just kind of keep hiring, you keep hiring. I mean, we grew up to, you know, when I was at Headscape, we grew up to 20 odd of us. And for us running the company, it was horrible. you spent less of your time working on projects, more of your time managing people. There was a bigger pressure to bring new work in the whole time. I really found it quite a tough period. Lee, I mean, I'm quite interested in your perspective, because obviously you've been at Headscape since almost the beginning. Do you prefer it bigger or smaller?
I prefer it now it's smaller again, which is where we started. The amount we grew it so quickly, it kind of led to a period where I could no longer see the edges of what we were doing anymore. There were more projects going on than I even knew about. I mean, that still happens with a small team, but nowhere near as much. I think there was already a tendency to, you could just get sort of lost on the wayside of things, because there were other projects going on which may have been more important than you, your own project, and people just kind of focused on those. I much prefer a smaller team and how things are now.
Dan, have you and Ryan talked about what you want to do in the future and No Divide? Do you see yourself growing again?
We've spoken about it. Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it's kind of deciding on where we want to take the company. As you say, having a bigger or smaller agency, I don't think it really matters too much in terms of your output. You know, obviously you can output less as a smaller team, but that might be of a greater quality than somebody that's a massive team, you know, but they're completely unrelated, I think, to a certain extent. Especially when it comes to quality. I think for us, it's more about thinking about what direction we want to take the company. And for us, I think we want to focus more on creating our own products. And so ultimately, we've already started doing this and we're already building our own products internally. And what we're trying to do now is essentially structure the team in a way that we have like a product lead and we have developers and creatives that are heavily involved in creating and developing those products. And maybe what we've discussed is what we'd like to see is perhaps then expanding the team into, we keep that core team that we've got working on product, but then we have an expanded team that works on client services. Now we wouldn't completely exclude them. It's not like we'd have 3 or 4 people working on client services, 3 or 4 people working on our products. They would have crossovers. But I think if you were to expand, it would be because we've got a product that we now need to maintain and, you know, build upon. And also we want to do client work. So we probably need to expand. But I think the team that we have now would probably be more heavily involved in, like I say, in the management and ongoing production of this product or products that we create. And that's just because that's the kind of stuff that really excites us. And it might be that, you know, when we hire, maybe we do hire people to just work on that product and we just become solely a product team. But I think at the moment we don't want to completely step away from client work. So, you know, if we are to hire again, it will be, on the basis that they'll be working in client services and also crossing over into our product side. But, you know, obviously until you launch product, we don't know, you know, how that's going to go. You know, it could completely flop, or it could completely take off, or it could just remain kind of in the middle. So depending on what happens with that as well and future products we create will, I think, influence us and our decisions about who we hire. And I think that's the main thing that we're doing is essentially kind of taking a sit back and making sure that we're only hiring people at the right times. Saying that, you know, we potentially may be on the cusp of getting a pretty big contract, in which case we will simply need to hire because we don't have the manpower to kind of handle it right now. So that's kind
but
of.
Will you hire a permanent member of staff in that situation, or will you get in a contractor or a freelancer?
We probably will hire, for this particular contract that I'm talking about, if we get it, we'll probably hire permanently,
right?
Based on a 6 month initial kind of contract.
Yeah.
And you know, the reason for that is just because of the size of the project, we just would need somebody on it for at least 6 months anyway, so it would be more cost effective for us to hire them even for a whole year. That we would still, you know, be profitable.
Yeah. True. Talking of products and things like that, I mean, it blows my mind that you guys have not hired somebody, especially as a husband and wife team. I mean, do you ever get a break?
No, never get a break. There's only just two of us. I mean, I was thinking about this in terms of going back to the, you know, the question of growing. Is it always good to grow? I guess if you're doing a good job, either as an agency or as a product company, there's always going to be a sort of slight snowball effect. Mm-hmm. If you do a good job for a client, okay, that project will finish, but they're going to be coming back, even just occasionally, with more work, or even, you know, little bits of changes or additions or what have you. So you tend to, your workload tends to just grow and grow and grow and grow, just through the natural course of things, unless you're doing a terrible job and really annoying all your clients and they never come back. Mm. So from some respects, it's almost inevitable that you've either got to grow or you're going to be overloaded with work and you're going to start taking on less work or something like that. Mm. But yeah, from our point of view, yeah, it is just two of us, and we've been going 7.5 years on the product with two people, and things are I guess a lot slower now, because there's just, again, with a product you get this snowball effect of so much code to maintain, so many features to revise. Mm. And what have you. Yeah, I think we'd like to grow. Mm. But I'm not a very good delegator, that's part of it.
Tara, you must be a much better delegator. This must be your kind of area.
Well, so it's interesting. I've with the company that I'm at now, I've kind of watched us change and grow. So I've been with the company for a little over 5 years. When I first started, our size was around, 35, 40 people. And I watched us grow to almost 100. And then, wow, I lost us lose down to almost 50. And now we're kind of back in that growth pattern again. We're getting back to where we're about 70 people strong. But, one of the things that Dan was talking about was, focusing in on, do you have to immediately replace a person when you lose them? And that's where we started really honing in and putting our focus in on. What we realized is that when you have always kind of been sort of a smaller shop, you have sort of a family mentality. You've got a culture that you can't, train and educate other people to know what it's like to have that type of culture for the company. And we started finding that as we were trying to quickly hire in new people to replace the ones that we lost, we started to lose who we were as a company, and we started to lose some of that culture mentality. And so we decided to take a step back and just really look at our workload and see, with the clients that we had, were we able to operate a little more lean? And so we actually went on a hiring freeze for about 6 months to allow us to just catch up and kind of redefine who we were. And then slowly we started hiring back in. But I think any company, whether you're, a team of two or a team of 100, you can operate lean. You know how to do it. It's just, how do you facilitate it with everyone else?
I struggle a little bit with this term where people talk about operating lean, because you got to be careful that isn't kind of code for making everybody work harder and putting more pressure on, haven't you? There's a balance there.
No, absolutely. And that's what, we kind of had to keep a close eye on. Fortunately, we weren't in a mindset where we only had one designer or one UX developer. Mm. We had multiple people that served in those roles. But what we tried to do was limit the amount of client work that was coming in so that we could see and map out, with the amount of client work that we have, are we able to still maintain profit while keeping sort of that work-life balance with the staff that we have. And so what we started to do was become more smart with not saying yes to every single client that came in. And from there, we were able to start shaping what was the direction we wanted to go as a company. So instead of focusing all of our time and energy on, projects or maybe only a couple of thousand dollars here or there, we could start going after larger, longer scale projects that allowed us to have more dedicated teams where they were able to operate and work on 1 to 2 clients instead of in your traditional agency mindset, working on 15, 20 and you're task hopping every single time.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like the absolute crux of it really with it is, and that's what it got me thinking about with this, because it was especially relevant, I think, when we had 2 project managers and only obviously 4 other members of staff. And then when that one of our project managers left, it was kind of like, okay, do we need actually, although there was always work, you know, always found work, there's always work that could be done, but do we need to? And actually, would it be the right thing just to bring in, like you say, bring in somebody else that maybe is just going to jump into a company that maybe doesn't fit just because, oh, we need a PM because we've lost one. And that is that's where this kind of article perfectly fit in into my story. And I think everything you said there was just like, yeah, spot on really. Exactly how we felt, although it's a much, much smaller scale. We definitely weren't in the, you know, we're not in a 50 to 100 size, but you know, culture is something that we really want to kind of get right. And I think it's really hard as well as a remote team to get that. So, you know, getting the right people, I think, is even more important when you work remotely, because they've got to not only be willing to work the way that, you know, you kind of have to, you know, with our clients and everything, but also as a remote team can be really hard for certain people. But I'm often that wasn't too boring, I don't think, that chat.
No. And I'm often surprised at actually how many of these issues are irrespective of size, you know, that you're going to struggle with growth, whether you're 100 people or whether you're a 2-person business, as to, you know, whether you should grow, when you should grow and those kinds of things. And talking of universal problems, it brings us on to Tara's topic for the day, which is scope creep, which if you run any kind of service-based business is a huge issue. So what was it you wanted to talk about with that?
So one of the things that's been kind of on my mind lately is, you know, you look at it and you always kind of lay it down where it's like the project manager is the one that is in charge of 3 primary things when you have any client. You know, they're in charge of managing timeline, budget, and scope. Mm-hmm. But what happens is you find that you've got other people within your company, or even if you're just a freelancer working on your own, you have to understand how to go about managing a client's expectations and understanding, you know, when does scope creep kind of become available or actually starts happening on the projects that you're working on. So I kind of want to open it up to the team. I know a lot of times when you start hearing that word scope creep, you tend to forget about, you know, there are so many other different types of creeps out there. So, you know, the one that's always freaks me out the most is hope creep, which is, you know, when your team starts telling you that everything's going fine, everything's good, it's great. And then bam, everything falls apart. So it's, you know, how do you go about managing this and making sure your clients are in the know that these things are happening when sometimes you're not even in the know?
There's a similar one to hope creep, which kind of relates to scope creep as well, which I see a lot, is that something's beginning to go wrong, but it's okay, we can pull it back, we can work evenings and we can work at weekends, there's no reason to scare the client, you know, we can save this. And so there's this kind of hope and expectation you can turn things around, and then that doesn't work, you know, you don't manage to catch up with the deadline or catch up with the work or whatever else, and then so you end up telling the client at the very last minute that things have gone to shit because you've hoped all the time you can pull things back. And so I mean, that's the primary lesson that I've learned over the years is to actually be honest with the client up front. You know, as soon as you think something might go wrong, say to the client, look, we're falling a bit behind schedule, we're not sure we're going to meet the deadline, you know, we're going to try our best, and then you can only exceed expectations, can't you?
Yeah, but at the same time, it's not just the expectations of your client, but it's the expectation of your team. One of the things that I've always tried to do when I work with teams is I have a no surprise clause, or basically a no bullshit clause, where if you're going to shock me or surprise me with something, then you're going to ruin this project. And I promise that I'm not going to be, you know, trying to oversell and underdeliver and try and have you having to sit at the office for, you know, 20 hours straight trying to pump coffee into your veins to make you stay awake. If you promise me that you're not going to bury your head in the sand, if you realize, you know, from an expectation perspective, you just weren't strong enough to figure out how to do it. So don't surprise me with bullshit.
Mm. But then the flip side to that, which I can kind of understand from a client's point of view, is that, you know, a client comes into a project and they haven't necessarily done this before. They're not digital experts. They don't know all the ins and outs of it. So they write this brief of what they think they want, and the project gets going. And then as they're exposed to the project and add the process and they're learning stuff, they're going to think of new things. They're going to think of new functionality and stuff that they want. So how do you deal with that kind of stuff? Because I can kind of understand that.
So for us, you know, one of the best things you always say is like document, document, document. You know, change is going to happen. And one of the strongest things that you need to be able to do as a project manager is learn how to be flexible and adaptable. Mm. So document what those changes are and have straight conversations with your clients of, you know, is this something that is absolutely necessary? Does it tie back to a business goal that's going to help you in the long run? And if that's the case, then is there something that you can eliminate, or do you have additional funds that you're able to, you know, utilize and issue a change order to make that happen? But I think a lot of times people are just afraid to have those conversations. And, you know, we always say that we want to under promise and over deliver. But when you do that, what's the risk that you're running into from your own business perspective? Are you giving away so much that you're never going to see another dime out of a client?
Mm. Lee.
Yeah, when you mentioned documenting, and it's something I've been trying to do as projects go on, trying to document and log all the little changes that happen so you can refer back to things, you know, when decisions started to go down a different path. I just wondered how you did that, because I mean, I'm not a project manager, so quite often my attempts to do this kind of collapse under pressure of other work. But is it something you kind of just document in something like Basecamp, or do you have a specific way of doing it?
Sure. So we have a different project management tool that we'll use that we allow clients to come directly in and see every single, you know, status of every single task that we're working on. Come to realize that using Google Docs is probably one of the easiest things in the world of managing changes to scope. Mainly because you can see all the iterations of what people are doing to change. One of the things also is that we try and make sure that we don't just automatically start to implement something, that we have that conversation. And then if everyone's kind of on the same page and looking at that same document, then you can go back and say, okay, well, back here is where we mentioned, and it's all timestamped anyways. But we also have all of our project managers send out weekly statuses to each of their clients that they're working on. And in those, they will document, was there any changes to scope or any new discussions that came about? And that kind of helps with that change log mentality.
I mean, another big problem with scope creep, of course, is not just whether they've got the additional budget to pay for it, but whether you've got the capacity to deliver that internally. So, I mean, how do you deal with that kind of thing? Do you make use of, well, let's do that in phase two a lot?
We do. We're fortunate enough that we do have, you know, a pretty deep bench over here where we're able to pull in additional people if we need to on a project. But not a lot of companies really have that capability. So sometimes when you're having that conversation, again, it's always that project manager triangle, good, fast, cheap. So how quickly do they actually need this new feature that they want to add in? So is it something that can wait till a phase two, or if it's something that has to happen for this particular project, then we need to extend and push out that timeline. It's all about the conversation.
Dan, how do you deal with that? Because, you know, obviously you guys are much, much smaller. So, you know, if somebody suddenly turns around and says, you know, there's this new big complicated piece of functionality I want and I've got the money to pay for it, could you do it? You know, that must present some interesting challenges for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It does happen. We worked on a very long, long project last year, you know, where the product was, you know, a very, very complex system, and everything was MVP. You know, the sort of, you know, it didn't matter kind of how unsure we were about if something was needed, it had to be there because it was, you know, everything was an MVP. So we kind of struggled with this ongoing when, you know, something would come up and it's like, oh, well, I thought it'd work like this, or, you know, could we use this tech, or could we try this? And essentially what we had to do is just, you know, we tried to be very transparent anyway with our clients, and like Tara said, have the conversation with them and say, okay, we can do this, but, you know, by us doing this is going to extend the deadline by a month, because the project wasn't, they had the money. So it was kind of like, well, I'm happy to extend it a month cost wise, but I don't want to wait a month for it. So it was kind of like they were saying almost, can you not chuck more people at it? But obviously we don't have the people. And the thing is what we try to do is just say to them that, you know, or to any clients that have this, you know, with us, we can't obviously just go and hire somebody because they want a feature, you know, or they want us to work, you know, do a month's worth of work in a week or whatever. We're not just going to go hire off the back of that, because the reasons they hired us are the reasons we set out right at the beginning, you know, because they like the way that we work. They, you know, the way that we all work together is also something that, you know, we can't just bolt somebody on, expect them to fit in with that. And it's also not going to make for the best project if we do that, and the best end result for them. So again, it's just really, I guess, about having that conversation and then giving them that option of, okay, well, how important is this feature that A, is not going to be released when you want because it's going to be, you know, put out by month, and is the financial implication for you worth this? You know, how important is this, and what have you got to back up this decision? You know, often there's not actually, you know, or no, maybe not often is the wrong word, but sometimes there's not the kind of reasoning or the data to back up the decision. So it's kind of like, well, our competitors use it, you know, for example, they've just redesigned their site and I've seen they used, you know, this search, and we're like, well, that's fine, but up till this point, they redesigned their site. That was never an issue for you. Suddenly now your competitors done this thing and you need to do it and it must be there, but it wasn't a priority before. So how much of a priority is it? And again, it's kind of reining in that kind of, because I think it's very easy to get excited as a product owner, where you think, well, you know, they do it, and so, you know, we must have that and we must have this because we want to stand out, and, you know, we want to be competing and we want to be winning. And I think it's easy to become overexcited and just think that everything must be there and every feature is important, when really, you know, maybe it isn't. So just kind of rein that in and open the conversation, have a dialogue, and, you know, and basically set out a plan. Like, that's what we would do. We would, you know, kind of work that into, you know, like a phase two, or, you know, part of a retainer or whatever. That's how we would try and work that. If it's really, really, they're not going to back down, they want it, then we'll say, well, what can we drop out that isn't as important as this new thing? And that obviously is a whole nother conversation, but, you know.
But the trouble with that, and, you know, I totally agree with you, your point that you were saying about, you know, a product owner gets overexcited about some new feature or something like that. But of course, the trouble is that sometimes what they push out to enable this cool new sexy thing is not always the sensible thing to push out. And that kind of brings us on to what Drew wanted to talk about today, because a great example of you know, the kind of thing that isn't sexy, that clients don't get excited about, but are hugely important, is things like performance. So, Drew, what was it you wanted to talk about when it comes to performance?
First of all, I take issue that performance isn't sexy. I think performance is very sexy.
So I do as well, Drew. Believe it or not, I do honestly get quite excited, but most clients don't, is my point.
Well, that was kind of my question. I mean, To put it in context, I think performance is massively, massively important. I probably have a disproportionately skewed view of how important performance is, because I try and it's for me, it's a primary concern in everything that I build, because I know that other people are building stuff on top of my code. So I try and make things as fast as they possibly can from the sort of fundamental design point of view, like how the sort of how the code is architected and everything, always performance is weighed in there as an important factor, almost as much as things like usability and accessibility. Performance is one of those sort of key sort of cornerstones. So that sort of brings me on to the question, because it is increasingly important. It's important for user experience, because a fast responding site or app provides a better experience for the person using it. And that's been measured and proven by people like Amazon who, you know, see massive increase in revenue for every millisecond they take off page load time and that sort of thing. It's becoming increasingly important for Google, who are starting to use it as a ranking signal. It's increasingly important for the number of users who are accessing stuff on mobile data, where things are slower as they, just naturally things are slower. And so the faster you can make your site, the better experience they'll have. So it seems like everything is pointing to the fact that performance is really, really, really important across the whole scope of your project. But is it something we're really selling into clients as a big feature? Is it something that people are really thinking about when they like choose their hosting plan, for example? Or are people only thinking about optimizing, you know, their JavaScript or, you know, compressing their CSS or minifying their images a little bit more? Is it a feature that you can actually upsell? And if so, how? How do you do that? How do you quantify how much like extra time better performance will take you to build into a application or a site, a project? Or is it something that you should just be doing anyway, and it should be reflected in the scope of work and reflected in what the client gets billed? Because go on.
No, I was just going to say, I think sometimes we sell things to clients in the wrong way, right? So at the moment I'm writing this book on user experience and changing culture within organizations using to be more user centric. And one of the kind of key premises that I talk about is, look, don't bother talking to management or colleagues about the needs of users because they don't really care. You know, everybody's quite kind of selfish and they care about things that affect them. So they care about, you know, whether they're going to meet their targets, whether they're going to, you know, increase revenue or whatever it is that they care about. And Jared Spall wrote a great article about this with user experience, saying, look, you're never going to be able to convince the, you know, management to care about user experience, but you can show how user experience enables them to deliver what it is that they do care about, whether it be stockholder value or whatever else. And I think the same applies whether you're talking about accessibility or whether you're talking about performance or whatever. I think personally, I wouldn't go to a client and sell them performance, right? Personally. But what I would sell them is, you know, the fact that they want increased brand visibility. Well, that means that you need to be well listed on Google, and performance is one of the things that affect that, right? And I would sell to them, you know, additional leads or revenue being generated. You know, that's something people want to see. And mobile is now the one of the biggest growing areas in that kind of area. And so therefore performance matters. So it's kind of matching, in my mind, it's matching performance against things that people already care about. Does that kind of make any sense?
I think it does make sense, yeah. I guess the sticky point comes where you have to persuade the client in some way to spend more money because of it. For example, if they've got some existing hosting that they're asking you to launch a new site onto and it's rubbish, it's really slow and awful, and you've got to say to them, no, you actually need to, you know, you're spending X thousand on this website. You need to spend more than, you know, $5 a month on your hosting. Otherwise, you know, that's going to waste and it needs to be faster for these reasons. Do you think there's a case to be made there?
Or I think you need to be able to show them. I think that's the big thing with most clients that I work with, is that you can tell them something to your blue in the face, but if you can show them it, it will make all the difference. So if you can demonstrate, you know, if you could do, for example, a video and you could have, you know, their page loading on one server, split screen, and their page loading on another, that they would get. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that's where something like Web Page Test is incredibly useful. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not actually.
So there's a site called Web Page Test, mm-hmm. and you put in the URL of your website, and what it will do is actually a film strip of your site loading frame by frame, showing you how it loads bit by bit.
Wow.
Timing. So what you could do is, if you have a project on a staging server of your own, which is nice and fast,
yeah,
and you have their existing hosting, you could run the same thing on both and show them the difference in a graphical form.
See, that I think is those kinds of things that I always think work so much better with clients, you know, because being able to see the frustrations is very different. You know, if you say, well, it's a you know, 2 second increase in load time, you know, well, big deal. People can wait 2 seconds. But if you show that difference and you feel that difference, that's so much more compelling. Lee, what's your feelings on it?
I love that idea of what you just mentioned, web page test, especially if you showed them their competitor in the frame opposite their side.
Good idea.
That would really sell it to management and to the performance being a really important thing.
Yeah, because I mean, that goes back to what Dan was saying about how you know, clients see something on a competitor's site and they get, we've got to have that too. So if you showed that with the web page load time, that would really do it.
And
I love that.
Show their page crawling as their massive carousel starts loading.
The other thing that site does is give you grade ratings on different aspects of performance.
Yeah,
they'll give you like an A to F. Where the A is all nice and green and shiny and the F is red and bad. So that's another thing you can do, is again with competitors, say, look, your closest competitor is, you know, got an A grade for this aspect and your site currently has an F, and our target for your new, you know, your new project is we're going to bring it up to an A, or because of whatever constraints, we're going to bring it up to a C or a B. And that'll give you actually then something to aim for and to show to the client that you've actually achieved what you set out to do and that you're delivering on what you promised.
And things like that make a huge difference, having those kind of metrics that you can measure against, you know, and measure yourself against your competitors makes such a difference. By the way, I come out as almost all A's on that site, except my cache. For some reason, my cache of static content is not working. I wonder why I didn't. Sorry, I'm getting distracted now. Oh, I see. It's my avatars that are being pulled from Gravatar that are not cached.
Yeah, it's amazing how it highlights the things that are a problem.
Yeah.
And it can really help in optimizing load. Yeah, things like Gravatars, what tends to happen is your site will make a request out to the Gravatar server, and then if the user hasn't got a Gravatar, it'll then make a request back to your server to get your default image, which will then return back to you. It's a bit crazy. But it's useful that it highlights that sort of thing.
So I'm going to risk running over for a few minutes because I do want to just touch on Lee's subject, because I feel that in some ways it follows on talking about the stuff that clients get excited about and they get all enthusiastic about a certain thing. And often those are upcoming things, right? So for ages it was mobile apps, wasn't it? And then, you know, and then the one I'm hearing a lot is at the moment is, which just makes me smile even to say, is virtual reality is the new thing that everybody seems I'm hearing a lot of talk about. Lee, what was your kind of point around this?
I think it's like artificial intelligence as well. The point was, when do you sort of start actually looking into these things, and when is the right time? Because we're all kind of scared of wasting time on new stuff because it's shiny and it might not actually take a hold, but then you don't want to be left behind either. So is it just something we should always all be looking at all the time, or are there better ways of kind of just knowing what's taking off and what isn't? It's a bit of a big vague area, really, to discuss.
It really is. And it's really tough as well. I mean, like the one that I'm umming and ahhing about at the moment, right? Virtual reality, I think, little way away, you know, for anything other than gaming, I think it's going to be a little, however amazing it is. So that I've kind of parked in my head. Augmented reality, I think, is really interesting, but hasn't majorly taken off. There's not been a big player in it. Artificial intelligence is just way out of my field of expertise. So I think that is hugely important, but it's not something I have to worry about in my particular skill set. But the one that I'm interested in at the moment, I can't decide whether it's worth my time, is chatbots. And this idea of a user interface that isn't a graphical user interface.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I meant by artificial intelligence as well.
Yeah. And I just can't work out whether it's worth my time to put into it. I mean, Dan, you know, I know Ryan likes playing with new and shiny. So he must always be looking at this kind of stuff. But do you set aside time for staying up with all this kind of thing?
Aside time for different things. So, I mean, we set aside time, for example, we only work 4 client days a week, and we work at least a day a week on our own products. And that's because of what I was saying earlier about the fact that we want to get our own products out there.
Yeah.
And therefore having, you know, scheduled time in our schedule, I don't know if that's right, but you know, allotted time there to work on those things, I think, is really important. I guess for us, it's kind of understanding or realizing, you know, what it is that we're getting into. I think, for example, I'm with you, Paul. I don't really see how, well, I can see how in certain industries, I guess, how AI or VR, you know, sorry, let's just say, it's probably going to start to play into, you know, the app space and the web space and things like that. For us, it's not a priority, like getting in and learning those things because they're new. I think the way that we've always approached things is that whatever we're going to be learning, if we're going to be learning something new, then what's the reason for doing it? If it's just because it's new, then we sort of question why we're doing it. And that's really just because of time. Like, we only have so many hours in the day, as we all do. And, you know, would our time be better off looking into performance and how our sites can perform better for our clients, you know, by, you know, learning something new there? Can we perhaps optimize, you know, the experience for our client sites? Would that be better use of time? And so, you know, we haven't really got any specific time set aside for learning these things. We always question whenever we're starting a new project, right, what did we learn from the last one and where did we struggle? So, you know, and that might be that we just simply start using something like we're using Algolia as a search engine, it's just like a search tool, because we found previously when we were building search that was like a huge task that we spent far too long on. And actually what we can do is just utilize something by learning how to implement Algolia. And that was like a really simple thing, but it saved us loads of time and, you know, it made a ton of difference to the client as well. And then we, you know, it's suddenly something new we can start to, you know, sell into our clients and, you know, utilize and things like that. So those things are like more of a priority to us at the moment than just simply, for example, looking into VR or AI. Doesn't mean they're not important. Like, you know, I think, you know, depending on what you're working on, I would love to get into the like the messenger bot kind of space, especially I think for product teams. I think that's something that can be really useful. Again, it's kind of, you know, we see pretty much every product that I've gone to use has one of those, you know, Zopim chats. You've probably seen them, you know, sit in the bottom right and, you know, hey, I'm Johnny, have you got any questions? And I think if you can actually tie that into something like Messenger, where the client might already be, your potential user might already be, and they can ask you questions about the product or, you know, things like that. And it's all, you know, pre-populated with various answers and stuff, things like that. I think, you know, that's interesting to me because I want to get into product. But, you know, equally, I've seen that work for people like Ollie Mers, who are using it to interact with fans. So, you know, it's, you know. Totally.
I think the problem that I'm having with it, with this kind of stuff, is that clients kind of expect me to have an opinion on it. Tara, I know Lee's got more opinions on this, but I'm quite interested, because you're a part of a larger agency, do you guys have anything like an innovation team?
We are trying to, but we seem to find that client work is taking over our ability to be innovative, which I guess is a good thing because, you know, we get to keep the lights on. One of the things that we did do is we sort of started our own incubator concept here. So if you had a developer or a designer that had an idea of an app or something that they wanted to focus in on, it's interesting to hear the conversation going on about, you know, wanting to be more product focused. We actually have two products that we're rolling out ourselves. So that's kind of where we're trying to do that innovation piece. Mm-hmm. But looking at it from like VR and things like that, we haven't even attempted to tackle it. Like, I can see where it could be a benefit if you're looking at things from like a university perspective, and maybe you want to utilize VR to do a walkthrough of a campus so you can see what it's like. But then you have to, you know that the people need to have the right hardware. Like, it just becomes very difficult to try and plan for all the new things that are coming out there when you're barely keeping your head above water for all the active things that you currently have going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Lee.
No, well, that was based on my question about research and development departments. And when the client seems to have more knowledge about stuff that's coming up than you do, because maybe they do have a research and development department, that can be a little bit intimidating.
I think to some degree, is it not just kind of, you can't know everything about everything, and for me, it goes back to that old T-shaped model, doesn't it? You need to, I need to be aware of these things. I would be a bit disturbed if, you know, a client turned around to me and said, what's your thoughts on so-and-so a bot? And I'd never even heard of it. That would worry me a little bit. And I would at least want to know what it does or what it potentially offers. But, beyond that, I think there's only so much you can know.
Yeah, I'll rely on Nuzzle to trawl my Twitter feed for things that pop up a lot.
What? Nuzzle? There's another one I haven't heard of.
It's an Android and iOS app, I guess, that just looks at your Twitter feed and it kind of pulls to the surface things that are mentioned a lot, and things that people you're following mention a lot and people they're following. So yeah, it just pulls things to the surface rather than you monitoring Twitter all the time to see what was cropping up time and time again, which is usually a good indication to what's kind of taking off out there.
But you get something like, you know, the trouble is you can get things that are fads, can't you? And sometimes potentially quite long-term fads as well. Yeah. And then they're gone and they evaporate. If you want to take a really extreme example, and you can't call this a fad, but you know, I remember when Flash first came along and I made a decision. I remember going, my brain doesn't work in this way. I can't, and so Flash, I never spent any time really with Flash. And, you know, I'd like to claim that I knew that one day it would disappear. But, yeah, of course, that was why. But, you know, there are technologies do come and go. And, you know, how long do you invest in these things?
The amount of time I wasted learning Flash and making mouse following kind of.
No, we made quite a lot of money out of you. We made a lot of money out of you learning Flash, so that's fine.
See, it wasn't all wasted then.
No,
not transferable necessarily, but it was good for the time it was there. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's Lee has brought possibly the impossible question to answer. How do you decide what to keep up with? But you know, so everybody that's listening to this knows none of us have got the answer to that question. We're all flailing around trying to keep up with this incredible speed of development. So that wraps up for the discussion. I want to quickly mention our second sponsor for the day, which is Currency Fair. Currency Fair basically allow you to save up to 80% on international transfer fees and exchange rates. So you know how many companies say, it's free transfers, there's no commission, etc. But then what they do is they give you a really shit rate of exchange, so that they make their margin off that rate of exchange, which means it gets really expensive. I mean, I do a lot of work with the States, And although I'm benefiting hugely from Brexit at the moment and the really weak pound, I do pay a huge amount, you know, in the just bad conversion rates between currencies. Now, what's really nice about currency fare is that actually they average only 0.35% off of the rate quoted, you know, the kind of generally accepted rate, the kind of thing you'd find on Google. So customers have transferred over 4 billion euros through currency fare and saved about 145 million in the process. And their rates are kind of, they constantly change all the time. So they're constantly being updated. So you can check at any time on their homepage what their rate is. You can either set it to transfer immediately, or alternatively, you can schedule it for later when the rate hits a certain level, which is brilliant. So a couple of examples of use cases. If you run a small agency or a small to medium sized company, then you can pay suppliers in multiple currencies around the world, which is great. Or alternatively, if you're receiving goods from around the world, then you can receive them in various currencies through currency fare. And also, if you've got presence in more than one country, you can move funds between the various countries that you're in, all through using this system. So if you want to find out more about it, check out currencyfare.com/BOAG. So it's totally worthwhile if you really are dealing in multiple currencies, which I think is pretty much all of us these days. So that pretty much wraps it up for this week's show. Let's get on to, Dan has just put in the type, are we ever going to get onto your subject? Dan, you know that my subject is rubbish and that I'm trying to avoid actually covering it. That's what's going on there.
Yeah, I'll see what's happened here, Paul. You know, bring these people to, you know, get all these people to bring ideas and, you know, I don't bring any.
I've got nothing
own.
To offer myself.
That's right.
Just because I'm polite. I'm just polite. I put other people before my own.
I really wanted to hear about your subject, and this is my last week on the show.
Oh, no.
I'll just have to listen when it comes out.
I'll have to have a long conversation with you personally about co-creation of content. I'm sure that'll be the highlight of your week.
It will be, Paul. It will be.
So a quick roundtable of where people can find out about each of you. Let's start with our newest member, Tara. Where can people find out about you?
If you want to find out more about me, you can follow me on Twitter at @tcalledsimon or go to iamterra.com.
Iamterra.com. I like that. Lee, what about you?
Best place is probably headscape.co.uk. And I'm at Lee, L-E-I-G-H, on Twitter.
And Dan?
Probably the best place is Twitter, yeah, at DE.
Okay, Drew?
On Twitter, I'm at Drew M, and with grabaperch.com.
And if you want to join pretty much all of us, I don't think Tara is in, but pretty much everybody else, you can join us in our Slack channel as well by going to boagworld.com/slacking and sign up there. Marcus isn't here to give a joke, so I'm just literally going to give a joke from the Slack channel. Jason Brown had a great joke that I really enjoyed, which is a man walked into a zoo. The zoo only had one animal, and it was a dog. It was a shih tzu. Shih tzu?
Shih tzu. Yeah, I think you fluffed the punchline there, Paul.
It's just gone silent, hasn't it?
And on that note, you we tell end
you,
the show.
Paul, you should have told that chemistry joke.
Which chemistry joke?
Well, to be honest, I don't know if you'd get a reaction.
Very good.
Terrible also.
Shih tzu. And on that note, we shall leave it. See you all again next week. Thank you to my guests. Thank you for you listening. And we'll speak to you again next week. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.